You're listening to the Setup Podcast, a podcast that helps you navigate new topics in music, tech, and entrepreneurship, with the most disruptive professionals in the music industry turning their experiences working behind the scenes into actionable advice you can use. I'm Sydney.
And I'm Sam.
And we're your hosts for the Setup Podcast.
If you're like us, passionate about paving your own path, hit the subscribe button on Apple, Spotify, or your favorite app, because we'll help set you up for success at the Setup Podcast.
I want to say a quick shout out to our amazing listeners. Truly, I created this podcast to help those who are new to the industry, just like I was once. And I'm very happy to learn that I can also provide insight to those who have been in music for a while. I want to give another shout out to all of our new listeners of the Setup Podcast. Thanks for tuning in.
In case you missed last week, we learned how Matt Lattice became Jonah Roy's manager and assisted Jonah in content brainstorming sessions to increase his fan base and streams by promoting his music on TikTok for his latest release of Pressure. So, Sydney, who do we have this week?
We have Charles Gadsden. Charles joined Massive Music in 2016 as Global Director of Growth. Together with the team, Charles is responsible for creating and developing relationships for award-winning brands such as the Lego Group, the Heineken Group, and ESL Gaming. Before joining Massive Music, Charles co-founded a brands partnerships agency where he worked with artists such as Daft Punk, Rihanna, and Pharrell Williams. Today, we are discussing how artists can leverage partnerships with brands for greater visibility and global reach.
This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. DistroKid is a service for musicians that puts your music into social platforms and streaming services. They have a cool new feature that gets your fans involved called Spotlight. You can choose a song and get your followers to vote for your song to be featured on one of their Spotify playlists. And as a bonus, your fans can also directly message you. Now let's talk about other great ways to connect with your fans.
Hello. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening.
How are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm running at like 60%. I'm all right though.
Exhausted or are you sick, not feeling well?
Completely exhausted. We're only on Wednesday. It's been crazy week, and I've got identical twin girl newborns that are like 4 months old.
Honestly, well, good luck with you for the rest of your life, because I don't know. So I'm Sam. I'm the one that reached out to you.
Hey,
this
Sam.
Is Sydney. And you might not be able to tell right now, but we're actually identical twins as well. Yeah, we are.
So ask our mom.
How did you get started? And please tell us how it led to where you're at now.
In all honesty, I think I'm going to go all the way back to when I was 4 years old, because not that I remember this very well, but when I was 4 years old, I was quite an active child, as my parents said. And I think they bought me a drum kit. I don't know why, for Christmas 1 year. And I was so into the drums that they thought, hang on, he's actually got some rhythm, or he's got a bit of a talent for this. Why don't we give him some drum lessons? So at school, I had some drum lessons and really, really enjoyed it. Then fast forward until I was maybe 12, when I started in the UK, senior school or high school. I was 12 years old, and you pick the subjects you want to learn. And one of them was music for me. So in the music lessons, they give you this keyboard and you have to play on the keyboard. And I found out that there was a drum kit in one of the rooms, and I hadn't played for years, obviously, but I started to skip the piano lessons and started to play drums. Then I bumped into some guys there who one played bass, one played guitar, and, you know, we started playing music together from the age of 12, and we started to just play music all the time, and I really, really loved it. And I loved it so much that we started a band and we started to tour, and then we got signed to a record label, and then we supported some ridiculously big bands. And then the band were about to sign to Parlophone Records, which is home of the Beatles and Coldplay and Radiohead at the time, obviously fired me. They went on to record at Abbey Road Studios and tour even the US and everything like that. My career kind of started there at that moment, because music has always been such a big part of my life. And I thought, man, wouldn't it be so cool if I worked in music as well? That'd be fantastic. So I played drums in a band and everything like that. So then I tried to get a job in the music business. And it's funny, when you're kind of in the band and you're like, you're hot, everyone wants to be your friend. But as soon as you're not in that band, nobody returns your emails, phone calls, nobody wants to know you. You're the guy who used to be in the hot band, right? So no one, but so I ended up working, I applied for a job at an Apple store. I didn't get it. I applied for a job at Domino's Pizza. I didn't get it. So then the job I got was working for a pharmaceutical company, sterilizing their labs after they'd been making drugs in there. So you had to wear like a full-on sort of Darth Vader outfit. Wow. And I would spend my days going into these labs with a toothbrush and, well, not really, but like sterilizing and cleaning everything with my iPod at the time in, listening to music and stuff and trying to like figure out what I could do next. So I did that for a few years or a couple of years. And then I actually became a cleaner. So they upgraded me so I could clean the offices. So I used to clean the offices. Then I met somebody who gave me a job working in adult television. So I was the cameraman for an adult television company. Then what happened then? And then I think I got a job at a music shop over Christmas. They were looking for people to sell to work over Christmas holidays. I don't know what you'd call them now, Christmas staff or whatever. And I used my time there to just order in all of these rare Japanese records, Japanese artists and things like that. I was really into Japanese rock at the time. And I used to say, oh, this is for this customer. This is for this. But it's always for me. And I used to collect them. So I really enjoyed that job. Anyway, they fired me. So then I, through a family friend, started to sell cash machines, ATMs. So my job was to go to like malls and try and sell cash machines. Then I, at that point, there is an end to this story. And then what happened was, I met a family friend at, we had dinner, we're at a burger joint. And he said to me, you like music, right? I'm like, yeah, I love music. He said, well, why don't you work for this company? They work in music and, they're a cool company and whatever. And in between all of this stuff, all these jobs, I was also managing bands. I forgot to mention that. Mm-hmm. So I'm like managing Icelandic bands. We won the Song of the Year, Album of the Year, Video of the Year, like the hot Icelandic band, South by Southwest, Iceland Airwaves, all the big festivals. The artist I managed wrote the first ever song for the iPhone advert. So in 2007, when the iPhone was released, the first ever song, that was one of my artists that wrote that song, which was awesome. I had bands signed to cool record labels like Kitsune, and we traveled. So all of that music stuff still happening, but I'm still like cleaning people's offices, right? So those are the two dynamics. Anyway, I met this guy. He said, why don't you work for this company? And it was the first time in my life that I worked for a company where I saw music as a product and not as somebody who's literally sweated and blood and, you know, tears, the whole thing, like creating this art, to then literally finding out that it's really just a product. And sorry, in between all of those other jobs as well, I was also consulting for some people. And I was also working at like artist management companies, like ATC, you look after Radiohead and people like that. And Chris Hufford is a really close person to me. He looks after Radiohead and Supergrass. So like I was always in and amongst it, but I couldn't get that job. So this was my first real job. And I have to say, I was left a little bit disappointed because I don't know whether you are musicians yourselves, but as a drummer, like when you listen to a song, I kind of know what kit they're playing. I have a rough idea, you know, I know what kind of type of cymbals, and like you can kind of picture in your mind a kit they're playing with a guitarist. I'm sure you could probably listen to the strings and what guitar they're playing and stuff like that. Like you really listen to the music. And when I worked at this company, they were talking about a product. They're talking about music buying. They were talking about leveraging price. They were talking about all of this, these words I never associated with this craft before. So it was an insight that was quite new to me. Having said that, I did that for a few years, and it opened up my world, opened up the world to me to, like the way that brands think about music, and the way that actually everyone's got a position in the team, you know, like, yes, you're an artist and you're a musician, but equally you've got to make money, and equally you can sell as many records as you want. And you can, you know, if you're fortunate to be like Kate Bush and just sell like millions of records, but never tour and stuff like that, like amazing. But most artists, they have to tour. Most artists, they need to play the game in some respects, working with brands, and whether that's working, performing at a festival that's sponsored by, you know, a beer brand or whatever it might be. You've always got to kind of play the game a little bit. And so it opened up my eyes to that, and it opened up my eyes to the way that brands look at music. And something that Sir John Hegarty said to me once, he's the founder of BBH. He is actually a sir. We had a 30-minute meeting booked, and it went on for 2 hours, and it ended not very good. But one of the things he actually banned me from the agency. He said, I'm not that. But the one thing he did say, which stuck with me, is he said, brands want fame. Brands want fame so much that they're willing to spend hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, for that association. And I was like, huh, isn't that interesting? You've got a brand like Ford Motor Company that's been around for what, 120 years or something like that. But they're willing to spend millions and millions of dollars to license an Ed Sheeran song for their advert, to be associated with fame or associated with culture. So this whole dynamic, this whole way of thinking really excited me. Music, brands, culture. I started to notice briefs. I used to get briefs from brands, and they all said the same thing. We're bold, we're millennial, we're disruptive, but we want to engage with a younger audience. How do we do this? And I'm like, well, you've just listed three words that basically are your audience, but you're saying you're not associated with them. So what if you licensed Ed Sheeran for $1 million? Would that be helpful? Like, yeah, that would be really good. That's what we want to do. So I kind of started to understand, being an ex-musician, working with musicians, working with labels, publishers, artist managers, event staff, guitar techs, you name it, that whole world. So also speaking with CMOs, brand directors, advertising, and really like in that sort of, you know, if you draw two circles and they kind of overlap, I'm really in this space here. It's quite niche, but I've been doing it for a while. My two best mates at that company, we all decided to leave and start our own company up. That was really good fun for the first 12 months. Because I don't know, I suppose it's a bit different for you because you're sisters, but if you go into business with your two best friends, especially if there's three of you and three boys, all with egos, it's probably never going to end well. And unfortunately for me, a bit like my band, that they kind of kicked me out. Again, a reoccurring theme. So I left that agency, and we did some great work. We were working with Lotus Formula One team. I think you saw it in my profile. All really cool work. Rihanna and Dior, the Palace of Versailles. Beautiful, beautiful work. Like really nice. And then I had a bit of a time of reflection, I suppose. I left the business for a few months, went to Bali and you know, and all of that stuff. And I really asked myself, what is it I want to do? And what is it that gives me joy and brings me joy? And where do I see myself? And I said, I remember like saying to myself, if I can call myself a music business exec, like an experienced someone in the music business, I think that's kind of where my heart is, because, you know, it's my, I'm not going to become a, whatever, like a kite designer or something, right? This is really like my path. I found this company online. They were called Massive Music, probably the same way you found them, just a bit of Googling, you know, who's this company? And I saw they had an office in London and I was living in London. So I contacted the managing director, Paul. I said, "Hey, Paul, I'd love to work for Massive Music. I think you guys look great. Have you got any roles?" He said, "Unfortunately, Charles, we don't have any roles, but why don't you contact me in 6 months and see where we are?" Thought about it and thought, I can't wait for 6 months. And I really got my heart set on this business. So I emailed him back a couple of weeks later. "Hey, Paul, I'd love to come over for a coffee." He said, "Yeah, sure, come over for a coffee." So I went over to the office for a coffee. And then I said, "Have you got any jobs?" He said, "I haven't got any jobs." So I said, "Okay, let's do this. I'm going to set up my own competitive agency and I'm going to bring in three clients. Once I've got those three clients, because I won't be able to do the work, I'll give you those clients if you give me a job." And Paul said, "Fine." Okay, sure. So I set up my own little agency. I got Bang & Olufsen, Lego, and West Ham United, which is my football team that I support as a soccer club, as clients. And they said, "Yeah, we're really interested in working with you." So I contacted Paul. I said, "Right, Paul, I've got these three clients. What's the next steps?" He said, "What do you want your job title to be?" So I told him, and then I started working at Massive Music, and that was almost 7 years ago. I'm working with the biggest brands on the planet. When I say working with, like working with the brand, the marketing, CMOs, the agencies that are associated with them, biggest brands on the planet. I get to travel the world. And I'm really pleased to say that on that moment of reflection where I said, you know, if I could call myself a music business person, actually, I'd be really happy. And I have to say it's exactly where I am. Like I've really exceeded my own expectations of where I could be and what makes me super happy. And more importantly, the value that I can bring to those brands, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the short answer.
Well, first off, thanks for your complete honesty with everything that's ever happened. How freaking interesting that was going to get. I have to ask, you know, out of the times that you've been fired, let go, however you want to phrase it, at the moment, it was clearly terrible. Like I've been through similar situations, but now from that, I've realized like it's exactly where I need to be and what needed to happen. And so I need to ask you, like, when you look at that, how has it helped you and what you're doing now?
It's a really interesting question. And look, I've been in therapy for a number of years, and the therapy is really helpful. It has a bit of a negative connotation with especially guys my sort of age and whatnot. But I'm very open about it, and it's been incredibly supportive for me because I wasn't educated in mental health as I was growing up, and neither were my parents, and definitely my friends were not. So speaking to my friends about certain things would usually just end up in, let's just have a drink and kind of be all right kind of thing. It's like the worst thing you can do. But my therapist said to me that throughout your life, you've experienced a number of situations where you've got very close to somebody or something, and that's fallen apart. Abandonment, you can call it that. So it was being with your best friends when you're 12 years old, doing something you absolutely love, and then at the point in which it's about to explode, it gets removed. Going earlier than that, my parents divorced at an early age. So I was 10 years old. So a couple of years before the band. So even that, like the divorced parents thing that lets you down. Then you're in a band that kind of lets you down. Then the people that I was in the band with all of that time, the managers, the lawyers, the accountants, let you down. Having those setbacks, as you call them, Sydney, like I think it gives you strength and gives you tenacity and gives you that extra layer of skin that's required. But in equal measures, it gives you this level of empathy and gives you this level of understanding to people's situations because you've been there before. And I can't tell you the amount of times that I've seen people that, like, that you're just in a really tough spot And I always try and do my best to help those people out. And if I get a cold email, more than often than not, I'll always respond, even if it's putting them in the right direction. I'll never just ignore it. And as I said, less than a decade ago, I was sofa surfing on benefits. And then 9 years later, I'm in this like dream position. And I do have to pat myself on the back sometimes because it could have gone so, so easily the other way. And what you're explaining there, Sydney, perhaps the people that have those setbacks, I think everyone has setbacks. I think even people like Elon Musk or whatever, you know, the most successful people in the world, however way you look at them, you know, everyone's had setbacks. I think it's just if you've had the training, or if you've been in the positive environment with parents and friends that have given you the tools that you need to adapt in those situations and to prevail and move forward, then lucky you. But a lot of people don't have that. And so this is why you perhaps see people that fall into alcoholism or drugs, especially in our business, which is music and entertainment, because it's very high stress, it's very competitive, and it's completely not gender or race diverse at all, which again is a bit of a joke. So
yeah, and I commend you for sharing your experience. I also share a similar experience where after the second job that I got let go from, I saw a therapist because I was just like, wait, what's going on here? Like, I know I'm good at what I do, but that's not enough sometimes. So flash forward to today. So now working at Massive Music, working with brands and pairing the right artists to your brand's campaigns, what's your process and approach for that?
Brands are always looking at different ways to what they would call move the needle. Okay. Different ways to impact culture, create a viral video, create more awareness, create more propensity to buy, create more customers, engagement, likes, view, whatever it might be. It's always fighting for that awareness. And something that that Sir John Hegarty said at BBH about brands, that they want fame. Like, brands want fame. That's what they want. When we're working with brands, the first thing I always say is this is not a badge and burn exercise. And what I call a badge and burn, it's like, hey, we're this brand, this is this artist, buy this product, and then it disappears. Like, and then you never ever see that brand and that artist ever talk to each other again. Happens quite a lot with booze brands, if I'm honest. They want to work with the hottest artist because they think that works, and then it kind of goes away. So I'm a big believer in not doing it that way, unless there's an authentic music program attached to it, like Dr. Martin's, you know, Smirnoff, Guinness, these types of brands that have long-standing, Jack Daniels have long-standing authentic music programs with different artists associated with them. That I do agree with, I think is excellent if you can pull it off. But our process really boils down to, what are your business challenges? So as a business, they will have challenges. If you look at their annual reports, like I'm talking to Goodyear at the moment, and I can see that Goodyear spent $300 million on advertising last year. So still during a pandemic, $300 million in advertising. You can assume that 10% of the advertising budget is spent on music, because when you advertise, quite often you have a song on there, or when you're doing a YouTube video or an Instagram video, you'll have music on there. So we usually say 10%. So that's $30 million they're spending on music a year. They probably don't know it, but it's a lot of money, $30 million. So what I usually say is look, you know, what are your business challenges? You want to engage a younger audience, or you want to do this, or you want to do that, whatever it is. Let's look at music as a tool. Let's see how music can be used to help with those business challenges and help assist the solution. Not saying it's going to be the whole solution, but might be able to assist it. Say one of your business challenges is saving 10% per year in costs. Let's just say that's one of the business challenges. Well, music is a really good way to do that. Because what you can do, and using Goodyear as an example, you spend $300 million a year in advertising as per their annual report, $30 million, is we'd say, well, look, looking at your business, you're spending $30 million a year on music at the moment. Well, if you make this change, this change, this change, you could perhaps save this amount of money, or perhaps more having a more strategic, longer term thinking about music, as opposed to just paying for music to put on advertising. Maybe there's a smarter way to go about doing that. So really the process is, for me, is diagnostics and analysis, and really identifying a business challenge or a business problem that they have. And then looking at music, because I work in music, looking how music can be used as a tool for a solution to those business challenges. And then it's a case of creating them a proposal of what that solution could potentially look like. Because what you've got to remember is we're quite often speaking to people that don't understand music as well as what we do, and just see it as a kind of like, as a thing you just stick on the end of ads or an advert or whatever. So really educating them on how it can be used as a tool is a really, really exciting part of that process. And then the other thing to mention around it as well is, like, you know, there's some brands out there that have such a positive affiliation with music. Like, I think Apple's a really good example. Although Apple doesn't have a jingle, for example, or a Sonic logo or anything like that, every time an Apple ad comes on the TV, you just know it's an Apple ad. Somebody at Apple has strategically thought about audio as a tool. Like, how can we use audio to trigger recall and awareness back to the brand? I think if a brand can get to that place where, in a world, Internet of Things, visual branding, visual, triggers and things like that is becoming less and less. Smart speakers are becoming a lot more popular. Wouldn't it be interesting, like, if all the brands that we know and talk to consider sound? Just consider it. Don't have to be the next Apple, but just consider it. Because if you don't consider sound as a crucial part of your, like, brand architecture, two things will happen. One, you will sound like everybody else because you'll just license Ed Sheeran and everyone license famous songs. You just license songs and everything, you just sound like everybody else. Or even worse, you become mute. You just don't say anything because you don't think about sound. You're just mute and then you're silent. I think the next few years, in terms of branded presence, it's going to be really interesting, really exciting. And we're looking at the tech brands at the forefront, but I'm thinking about, like, all different types of brands that you engage with on a daily basis. When you start engaging with that brand through a smart speaker or through your watch, how different that relationship will become.
You were talking through how music is connected with brands, and it almost triggers the mindset of humans, or if human beings are more conditioned by sound than they are by visuals. For instance, just from psychology, when you get conditioned over and over again by every time you hear, you know, a certain tune, that you associate it with an artist or a brand, for instance. And so how can artists approach you or directly to a brand to develop that music partnership?
I think it's a really interesting question. I'm just going to mention something about the point you raised. Okay. And it's absolutely true. When you're growing in your mother's belly, you can't see anything, but you can hear the heartbeat. Boom, 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 boom. This is all you can hear. So naturally, you understand rhythm. Boom. That's why you see those YouTube videos of babies dancing when they're like newborns, you know. So you understand rhythm. Is sound is the first thing. So we as humans totally associate sound with all different types of experiences. We used to play this video at conferences, and it used to be this house on a hill, just a wooden house on a hill. And we would play, like, I don't know what you'd call it, sexy music. And as the camera moves over, you're like, what's going on in that house? You kind of know, right? Then all of a sudden, you play like, dun, 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 scary music. You're like, oh, something scary is going. it's amazing how music and sound really has that psychological effect on you. But anyway, so the question about how can artists get involved with this kind of stuff, there's two ways, right? The first way is really with composers. So there's a difference between me, who can play a bit of guitar and a bit of piano, compared to an actual composer, somebody who's skilled, like that's their skill. They can play a variety of instruments. They understand how to read music and write music, and they just have a natural flair for creating compositions. That's one way of getting into the business, because a lot of the artists that companies like Massive Music work with and brands work with are most of the time composers. A brand will most of the time want something that's just for them because it makes them feel special and exclusive, unless they want to buy that fame piece, but they want something bespoke, and a composer has the skill to create something bespoke. But having said that, if you're in a band, you equally have that same talent, and you can get more involved in working with brands from a personal point of view. So, for example, there's a band called Sigaros, but you'll notice that Yonsi, one of the guys in the band, he does his own solo stuff with his husband Alex, and they do some work with brands. For example, even though he's in a band, he does stuff. Yanis, the lead singer of Foals, he does some stuff. And the way to do it, really, again, two ways. I'm very simple. I've always got two solutions. The first solution is to contact agencies and say, look, this is what I do. This is the work that I do. I'd love to do some work with X and X and X and X. And the second way is something actually that somebody said to me, like, if you're good, people will just come to you. Like, if you're actually good enough and you're really talented at what you do, people find a way to sniff you out. And a lot of the composers that we've worked with quite often have only done two or three projects, but we've noticed it through a friend or someone shown us or something like that. And it's such an excellent piece of work that you want to work with them. So Arsa is a Venezuelan artist. And she wrote an album, and it was like super cool and weird. And then Björk found her and asked Björk, and Björk asked her to produce her albums and do the beats for her and stuff like that.
Yeah. So what would you say is the impact on these artists' careers, other than the possibility of, expanding over borders?
Exposure and financial. Like, let's be honest, Sigaros, they never partnered with a brand because they weren't interested, perhaps, in associating themselves in a badge and burn exercise and didn't really seek that type of awareness. And equally, maybe they weren't driven by commercial success. But Coldplay have teamed up with BMW, so one of the biggest bands ever, who totally don't need awareness, totally don't need credibility, and totally don't need the money, a partner with BMW. So maybe I don't know what I'm talking about, but like, yeah, I think that particular partnership, it really stood out to me because it definitely doesn't feel like something that could go on for many, many, many years. I don't know.
Yeah. I think another aspect can be really solidifying a brand too. Like, let's say you're a new up and coming artist, you can work with brands that are authentic to you as an artist, that has similar vibes or I guess similar audiences for your music. And it can really solidify like how people see you. So I think in a lot of cases, like whether you're looking for, quick financial gain or like a long-term partnership, that's where it matters. And I think is most critical to their career because, you may think, oh, now, but like people can bring that back on from years ago and be like, why did you do that? So I think it really matters in that aspect of branding too.
It's such a delicate piece, but truth and authenticity will always prevail. Like when you look at the Daft Punk and the Lotus Formula One stuff, right? They wear helmets. race car drivers wear helmets. Like, it's like, get lucky. When you mentioned like the vibe, Sydney, like the vibe was perfect. Now, that partnership, in my personal opinion, is one of the greatest partnerships ever made between an artist and a brand, because it's timeless. Mm-hmm. Like, and Jay-Z said that he wants to create memories, not moments. I think that absolutely is a memory. Like Daft Punk, Lotus Formula One, launching random access memories at the Monaco Grand Prix on the side of Formula One. Like the partnership was just really, really truthful and authentic. And I think that's the key. If you can create something that's truly timeless and something that's truly memorable, then you won't have that situation where you look back in a few years and be like, oh man, why did I do that? Because that's selling out. I think Then you're doing things for the wrong reasons. Brands are in a fortunate position where they have so much access to any artist at any level. And I can say this from experience, even an artist, which is probably why the Coldplay thing doesn't surprise me, but even an artist that we might see as quite successful, if they've got a brand that's going to give them $25,000 for something that they're happy to do, more than often they're happy to do it. I remember having record labels phone me up and asking if I could find a brand to give them $10,000 so artist X could make a music video. I can tell you, again, being totally transparent, the Daft Punk Lotus deal, no money was exchanged. Zero. The artist didn't get paid. Wow. The Formula One team didn't get paid. It was complete zero. And this is the other reason why not many people do. But that's one of the reasons why I still think it's the greatest one, probably the greatest partnership I've ever seen, because it was completely win-win. Like, Daft Punk sold albums in places like Azerbaijan because there's a racetrack there, there's Formula One fans, and they're like, oh, who are these guys? And, you know, so they sold records there. And that Formula One car, if you Google it, Lotus Daft Punk, that Formula One car is the second or third most photographed Formula One car of all time.
Wow.
But what was funny is there was a picture actually in the Rolling Stone. It said some brands get skateboard deals or something. Some brands get apparel deals. Some bands get a skateboard or some bands get clothes, and then Daft Punk get a fucking racing car. But the picture they used was of the racing car, because it crashed, obviously, in its second lap, crashed, being airlifted out of the race, and it had hashtag get lucky on the side. Oh, so that for me was kind of like the cherry on the cake. But yeah, no money was exchanged because the band loved the idea, the team loved the idea, everybody won one. I mean, yeah, genius. It's really clever. So point being, if you're an artist, you've really got to think about the value you can bring to the brand. And I look at artists like FKA Twigs. She's super unique. She's super cool. She's not adhering to any trends. She's got her own style, got her own thing going on. Same with Arsa. Like, if you've got your own brand and your own personal brand and your own style, and you know you're staying true to that, like Daft Punk to an extent, you know, then I think that's definitely something you can offer brands. I think the moment you start acting and sounding vanilla, but from a brand perspective, if I was working for a brand, I'd want to associate myself with someone that I feel will be timeless. Doesn't have to be the best, the top, the most streams, the most likes, whatever, but just something that aligns to my brand values.
We have one last question. It's for you personally. What do you want to be known for?
What I'd like to be known for is somebody who didn't always follow the buck, but really looked at impacting culture in a truthful, positive, and authentic way. And I think if I can look back on my work that I've done, the projects that I've done, the partnerships, even the consultative pieces, and I can say everything I've done was for the benefit of culture and improving things and everything like that, and inspiring the next Charles Gadsden to be a drummer in a band, you know, that kind of thing, I think would be really cool. And actually, not that I would want to be known for, but if anyone who's listening to this podcast is in a really, really shitty rut and thinks that nothing can ever go right and nothing can ever happen, like literally, if I can do it and get on and be happy in a role, then anybody can. And anyone, feel free to reach out to me on email or LinkedIn and get in touch, because the more that we support and help each other and work together and just inject this world with some positivity and some, you know, and all of that, I hope to think it'll be a better place for my girls grow up than what it's in now.
I love that. That was such a powerful ending with us being women, especially where the world's kind of going at in the US right now. I definitely appreciate that last little comment that you had for our listeners out there. Charles, thank you so, so much for joining us for the last hour today. We appreciate your time. We appreciate your stories more. And even more, we appreciate the fact that you shared it with us and were being completely raw and genuine throughout the entire conversation.
I appreciate you reaching out and for you listening to me. As I said, I can talk and talk and talk. And actually, you being strangers, I don't know you, I've never met you. I totally felt comfortable in your presence. I felt totally at ease. And I think I was extremely open. And that's all down to you guys making me feel so, so comfortable. And like I said, like I've got nothing to hide anymore. And, you know, I'm not embarrassed by, you know, any of the things that I've mentioned. And like I said, if there's one person that says like, oh, what he says was, that's kind of cool, then this is why you do it, right? So,
exactly.
Yeah, I'm very happy and I'm very thankful that you reached out. It's been a pleasure meeting you both, really.
Thanks for joining me for another episode of the Setup Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please review the Setup on Apple Podcasts. And I encourage you to share this episode with your friends and colleagues. If you have any topic recommendations or questions, please visit us at www.thesetupseries.com.